The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them, so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and I welcome Nick Loy, a reader in military and imperial history at King's College London. His new book, The Western Front, is comprehensively the story of the Great War, looking at the war in Belgium and France, the war that we think of as trench warfare. This is the battle between allies and adversaries in Europe, the start of the 20th century, that cursed the 20th century because its lack of resolution. And the players in this battle, 1914 to 1918, become the predicate for the much more damaging to the earth war called the Second War in the 1930s and 40s. Everything here foreshadows the catastrophe of the 20th century, which we still bear. Nick, a very good evening to you. Thank you for this and congratulations. I want to begin with a conversation about how you approach this as a scholar. What you discovered in your researches in the German, the French, the American, and the British archives, and others, parts of the empire all participated, the colonies of Canada and Australia. The French Empire participated as well, the colonial troops. What you discovered in your researches and how it is that you approach this, what your ambition was as a narrative historian. Good evening to you, Nick.
Good evening. Thank you for having me. This was a big book. It was a big project that I took on, and I'd written a few books about the Western Front, different battles. I'd written a book on Passchendaele. I'd written about the last stages of the war on the Western Front. And then I thought I needed to do something bigger and more comprehensive. And, you know, I stumbled upon the idea that I was going to do a history of the entire front. So, you know, we're going to talk about, you know, this entire theater of war in France and Belgium between 1914 and 1918. And I'd looked at it in snippets and snapshots, really, and I thought I need to do the whole thing. So I think there was a number of things I really wanted to do with the book, which was really to emphasize that it's a coalition warfare. There's a whole number of states and nations and empires involved in the Western Front. And certainly from the British perspective, often we tend to focus on the British perspective, understandably, the British sector of the Western Front, the Somme, Passchendaele, the battles that we fought in. But of course, there's the entire French sector. There's the entire American sector later on in 1918. So, and there's a whole German story. So I wanted to bring all of that together in a sort of grand narrative history that takes you through the opening stages of the war. The German invasion of France and Belgium, and then goes through that whole process of how the Allies, how Germany fight the war, how they change, how they develop, they develop new technology, new tactics, and then how it all comes to an end in 1918. So to do the whole thing was obviously quite a big task, but it was something that I really enjoyed. And I think if readers go through it, they'll find in some ways quite a different story than maybe one they expected, but I think one that is ultimately more satisfactory than maybe what we have today, because we might want to talk about this, but the Western Front is so full of myths and misunderstandings and cliches that getting past all of that is a real challenge.
The preface to your book indicates you wanted to look at the operational level of senior commanders. The lens of senior commanders was your language. How does that shape this story, and how is that different from what we've had before, Professor?
Well, I think for me, understanding war and understanding this war is we have to start with the military aspects of it. And I think, you know, there's lots of other stuff going on in the war. There's the entire economic war. There's large parts of the naval war. I touch a little bit on the naval war, but, you know, there's the whole social changes that the war unleashed. And these are sort of in the background in my story. I focus on those people, those senior officers who were involved in the war from the early stages and the way that it went through. Because I think that in some ways they have been the people that are the most misunderstood. And, you know, they have largely been written off in the Western tradition as sort of donkeys or butchers and bunglers, as men that were incompetent, in some ways criminally negligent, and really fought the war in a terrible way. And this, of course, contributed to the futility and the stalemate that we see in that sort of middle period of the war. So I really wanted to just look again at these individuals and try to tell the story from their perspective so that the reader can in some ways step into their shoes. And I think, I hope, as readers go through the book, they will think, well, what would I have done? Would I have done something differently? You know, I think hopefully readers will be able to appreciate the enormous pressure and the enormous difficulties that these men had to wrestle with. And, you know, some of them made terrible errors. Some of them tried their best and still failed. Others did the right things and were successful. And I think it's that entire mix-up that will hopefully give us a more nuanced, a cooler perspective on the war. And, you know, we've got 100 years has passed since the war now. So I think the time is right for a more considered assessment of how that war was fought. And again, what it all meant, really.
We're looking at trench warfare in Belgium and France, 1914 to 1918. You indicate there will be other volumes that speak to the war in the East, the war between Russia, Germany, Austria, and the war with Italy, and also the war outside of Europe, the global warfare that was fought in Africa and the Middle East. Is that correct, Professor?
Yeah, well, you know, I've written books about battles on the Western Front, so I thought I need to do the whole Western Front. And as soon as I started on the Western Front, I thought, look, I've got to do the whole thing here. So it turns out that there's going to be a trilogy. So it's going to be one. This is the first volume of three. And obviously in this book, I allude to events that happen outside the Western Front. So there'll be an occasional mention of things going on in Russia or Poland or with the Austrians or Gallipoli in the Middle East. But those stories will be told in Volume 2 and Volume 3. So Volume 2, the one I'm working on at the moment, is the Eastern Front. So this is the Russian War. It's the Austrian War. We also have the Balkans in there. So it's an entirely different war than you get in the West, but it's an essential part of that story. And then we will go in the final volume to look at, if you like, what I call the wider war, the war in the Middle East, the war in Africa, the colonial war. And through each of the volumes, you will gradually, the picture of the war will hopefully emerge, and it will become deeper and more sort of nuanced as we go forward. And so the trilogy will be a complete history of that war.
One detail that comes again and again in different parts of the 1914 to 1918 on the battlefront is that events in Russia or events in Italy or events at sea, the submarine warfare, influence the decision-making on the battlefield. We need a victory, or we need to press on, or when Falkenhayn would ask for the submarine warfare to continue and be blunted. So the larger war preys upon decision-making on the battlefront. I had never seen that so clearly, Nick, until your book.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously huge numbers of factors that go into all of these decisions that we go through. And, you know, I think the key thing is the appreciation of these individuals, these commanders, are trying to win the war. And they're trying to, for the Allies, there is a coalition warfare. You know, they have to fight alongside, you know, or at least try to coordinate their activity with Russian activity. And they try and obviously fight the Turks in the Middle East. And so that is it's a constant evolution that's going through. But I do think for the Western Front, this is the front, the theater where it's ultimately decided. Now, Germany effectively wins on the Eastern Front. Russia goes into a revolution in 1917. It ends the war. But Germany cannot hold on the West, and ultimately that is what brings her down. So the Western Front is the decisive theatre of the war. It's where the war is fought by four great powers: Germany, France, Britain, and of course the Americans.
Let's go to the Germans, Professor. Let's start with the Germans. It is the summer of 1914. An event in Sarajevo has sparked everybody's sense of dread. The book is The Western Front. This is The History of the Great War, Volume 1, 1914 to 1918. The author, Nick Lloyd, from King's College. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, speaking to Professor Nick Lloyd, a reader in military and imperial history at King's College London. His new book is The Western Front, The History of the Great War, Volume 1. We attend immediately to the larger-than-legend personalities of the four powers, Germany, France, Britain, and America as the final power. We begin with Germany because a man named Moltke, a man who is the relative of an earlier commander of German forces, is in charge of the Schlieffen Plan in August of 1914, in conversation with the Kaiser. And I learned from you, Nick, that the Kaiser favored Moltke, but Moltke was a man who was dealing with the ghosts of his ancestor and also of Schlieffen. What do we need to know about Moltke that he took it upon himself to alter the Schlieffen Plan in the attack on Paris?
Yes, you've got the pressure on someone like Helmut von Moltke the Younger, it's his title, it's his full name, is enormous in 1914, and he's not up for it. He's a man that is, as you say, bowed down by the weight of victory that his uncle achieved in 1870 and 71 in the Franco-Prussian War. And he is, you know, he's concerned about the plan, the Schlieffen Plan, envisages a massive attack through Belgium and the Low Countries that will essentially outflank the French frontier fortresses the French have built, get the French army into the open and destroy it in a grand battle of envelopment. It's one of the most ambitious military plans you'll ever likely to see. But Moltke, you know, he feels very vulnerable and he feels quite insecure about having to do it, and ultimately doesn't have the nerve to actually put it into play in the way that Schlieffen envisaged, with that right wing, that sort of swinging door would be as strong as possible. So Moltke begins to alter the balance of forces. So he puts a little bit more force in the south on his left so that it's not going to be as powerful. And ultimately, he is already having doubts about whether this can be done, whether he can do it, what this is going to envisage. And so, you know, by mid-September, he's essentially been pushed aside because he's had a nervous breakdown. But I think early on in the book, you see the enormous pressures these people are under and the kind of steel and the kind of nerve you would need to perform well on something like the Western Front.
The Kaiser himself, Wilhelm, at various times he seems withdrawn or he's not ready for news. Other times he doesn't make decisions sharp enough or he doesn't trust his generals. Did he change through the war, Nick?
I don't think he changes. I think his character, as you know, many historians have pointed out, he's like a weather vane. He moves. You know, he can be very committed to one thing one minute, and then the next minute he'll lose interest or he'll switch to a different position. So for those people around him, they'd never really know where he is and what he's thinking. And ultimately, although he's a sort of commander-in-chief in name, he's not really involved in the day-to-day war. He can make important interventions at times. He can sack generals. He can promote people. He can have the say on grand, you know, something like submarine warfare. But he's not in a day-to-day commanding role. But of course, as the war goes on and you get a number of people involved that become very, very well-known, particularly Hindenburg and Ludendorff from 1916, the Kaiser kind of shrinks. He becomes less, not less important, but as a figure, he becomes less of a figurehead and he becomes sort of, in the shadows. And of course, he's quite insecure about all of this. And so he finds the whole war quite frustrating. And I think one of his early diary entries, he says to a friend, he says, well, you know, people think I command, but I don't. I just sort of, I go for walks and I chop wood.
Falkenhayn replaces Moltke in 1914, a man whom you identify as young for his post when he's raised up. He has steel. That's the only metaphor that I can think of in his backbone. What do we need to know about his vision of the battlefield?
Well, of course, you know, you've got this general sort of merry-go-round, and you see this through the book where certain generals become hired, fired, some generals will do well, and they'll go, they get promoted, and then they'll fail, and they'll go back, and some even recover. Falkenhayn is the Prussian Minister of War, so he's in an important position, and then he takes over from Moltke. And I think Falkenhayn is interesting for a number of reasons, but of course he's the architect of the Verdun Offensive, which is a battle which in some ways it sort of defines the Western Front, the battle that was fought predominantly to kill Frenchmen. There were no real territorial objectives. It was designed to kill the enemy in an attritional sense. So in some ways, Falkenhayn is quite a unique figure because most of the German generals, including von Moltke and including his successors, want to achieve a decisive battle based on maneuver. Falkenhayn doesn't really want to do that. And that's why I think Falkenhayn's an interesting character. And it also points to, I think, one of the great themes of the book, which is these different ideas about how you fight warfare that we get through different generals. Certain generals want to be more attritional. Certain generals want to be more maneuverist, want to be more based on mobility. And ultimately, nobody really knows what is going to be doable, if I can use that word, or what you can actually achieve on the Western Front, because it's such a, I call it a cauldron of war. It's such an intense exercise in violence that all these commanders are rapidly trying to work out what you can actually do in this new environment.
Bethmann Hollweg, the Prime Minister. I mention him because he is a man who's devoted to refusing Falkenhayn's wishes for unrestricted submarine warfare. Why did Bethmann Hollweg hold back, and how did he contribute to the troubles on the battlefront?
I think in Germany you have quite a, you know, the role of the politicians is, I think, quite significantly reduced or sort of lowered compared to the politicians in the West, in France and Britain. And those politicians, David Lloyd George, Clemenceau, they become more important as the war goes on. And they claw back some of the power that had been ceded to the generals in the early part of the war. I think with Germany, it's quite different. I think German politicians are in a weaker position, and the military hierarchy, the supreme command, have much more power, and they run the war. But of course, in terms of foreign policy, submarine warfare strikes at that quite deeply. So Bethmann Hollweg, I think, is, in some ways, he shares a lot of the maximalist ideas about, you know, Germany's role in Europe and what Germany can expect if she wins. But he's worried about a number of different things. They're worried about the Americans. They're worried about whether they can actually achieve submarine warfare. They're worried about the damage this will do diplomatically to the, you know, Germany's reputation. So in some ways, it's a difference over tactics. Falkenhayn and others want to use every weapon at their disposal, whatever it might be, to the maximum that they can. And I think that's a great failing of the German military, we see both in the First and in the Second World Wars, is tactical and operational effectiveness is elevated far higher than it should be. Political, diplomatic, strategic issues are kind of relegated to a secondary position, and that ultimately is fatal to the German ability to translate battlefield success into strategic victory.
The book is The Western Front, History of the Great War, 1914 to 1918, Nick Lloyd. We've mentioned the German authorities, the people who will make decisions early in the war, and Nick mentioned Hindenburg and Ludendorff, who will enter in 1916 and will address those after the catastrophe of Verdun and Somme. However, we're going to turn to the French now, because as Nick's work explicates, the French participation in the war was outsized. The sacrifice was outsized. It was largely fought in France and Belgium, entirely here. All the suffering was in France. And the Versailles Treaty that ended the war is explained often as French revenge. You can see the basis of it as we watch the French fight the war against Germany that invaded France. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Nick Loy, a reader in military and imperial history at King's College. His magnificent new storytelling is The History of the Great War, 1914 to 1918, on the Western Front, Belgium and France. You think of this as trench warfare. That was not the intention. However, it was the result of the opening stages of the war, and the French determined a deal of what was to happen in their defense of Paris. We begin with the commander of the French forces as the war opens. His name is Joffre. He is a man whom Nick describes as he does not panic. He did not panic. What do we need to know about Joffre, how his vision of the war took place, Nick?
Yes, I mean, he's one of the great heroes of the Western Front, one of the great heroes of the French army. I know he's memorably described in Barbara Tuchman's Guns of August that you may have read. He's a figure that in some ways is quite unimpressive. He's an engineer. He's not taught at the staff college, or he's not produced works of great military merit. But he has a kind of earthiness and a connection to the army that I think is really important in 1914, as well as under the shock of war, Helmut von Moltke, the German commander, collapses, essentially just can't take the pressure. Joffre can, and he is able to do what he can to defeat the Schlieffen Plan and the German invasion and counterattack at the Marne River in September 1914. And Joffre's ability to essentially absorb punishment, but to keep an eye through all the chaos of war, he just understands what is going on and he's able to react quickly. And I think that's what marks him out for greatness, certainly in 1914, is this ability not to lose his head, not to become too discouraged, to keep playing the game, keep moving his units, try to outflank the enemy, and ultimately that ability to just to have that sort of gravitas is really important. Again, Joffre is not particularly charismatic in that sense, but he is a really solid commander. And I think that is something that sometimes we overlook. And that's why Joffre is such a compelling figure in many ways, because he just keeps his head, he keeps his nerve. And if you look at the way he actually fights, I think it's very impressive in many ways.
Well, politics in France was everything during the war, in constant conversation, because Paris is 50, 100 miles from the battlefield and is often the target through the war of German raids, German bombs. So Poincaré, Raymond Nicolas Landry Poincaré, president of the French Republic, 1913 to 1920. There'll be a series of ministers who come and go, but Poincaré is always there, and he's heavily involved in the military analysis and war meetings in 16 and 17. What do we need to know about him? Was he what we would today call bellicose, or was he looking for political solutions, Nick?
I think, well, he's a nationalist and he believes greatly in France's mission, France's greatness. But I think what you see in certainly the first half of the war in France is that sort of realization that, you know, they have not won. They might not have been defeated, but they have come close. And moreover, that they need to do things differently. They need to remobilize. They need to, also from a political perspective, they need to start to claw Joffre in, because essentially for the first 4 months of the war, Joffre is basically almost a dictator. Almost every decision related to that war goes through him. And the politicians have gone to Bordeaux and they come back and they try and rein him in and try and reassert political primacy over the army. So the political situation in France is, I think, really key to understanding how the French army fights. And, you know, that pressure is constant on her commanders in terms of, you know, trying to re-equip the army, trying to attack and defeat the Germans, but also trying to bring the British in and continually try to get the British to commit more and more manpower to the Western Front. Of course, Poincaré is at the heart of all of that. And, you know, at the same time is they're having to deal with the situation that, you know, a significant slice of France is now under German occupation.
There are two generals who will emerge in the course of the battles of 15 and 16. Pétain and Foch, and we'll come to them, but a man who can be lost because he was momentarily the commander of all the forces once Joffre stepped aside in December of 16, is Nivelle, a complete surprise to me. He was an artillery officer who, I believe, Joffre spotted him, identified him as a man of the future. But Nivelle was a great disappointment and almost wrecked the whole French army. Why?
Well, no, that's a great question. And Nivelle is one of the characters I found one of the most interesting characters I was writing about in the book, because Joffre, you know, is a hero of 1914, but as the war carries on and, you know, he's not able to break through in 1915 or 1916, his reputation begins to become somewhat tarnished and he becomes somewhat tired. And as the fighting in 1916 goes on, there's a second army commander at Verdun, as you say, an artilleryman, called Robert Nivelle. And people start looking at him and thinking, this is someone special. And he has an ability to use artillery. He uses creeping barrages. He uses different techniques. He's quite a good soldier and he's able to get results. He recaptures Fort Douaumont, which is one of the most important fort in the Verdun fortress system. It becomes a symbol of French resistance. So Nivelle becomes this great battlefield hero. And I think at a time where France is weakening, you know, they've lost heart. They've lost so many people. They failed to break through in 15, and most of 16, and they suffered terribly at places like Verdun. The French government just think that Nivelle is, you know, he ascends very quickly. He rises really, really quickly because he just seemed to have the magic touch. And so, of course, he replaces Joffre. Joffre is essentially kicked upstairs and given a very high-sounding but ultimately somewhat impotent position. And Nivelle commands the armies. And Nivelle wants to attack. He wants to break through, which they try in the spring of 17 in the so-called Nivelle Offensive, which fails. But Nivelle ultimately is good at one level. He's a good corps commander and army commander. He's good in actually orchestrating small, relatively small scale operations. He is promoted way above his means. And as essentially a commander in chief, he tries to repeat what he's done at a lower level. And that doesn't really work because you don't have the amount of guns that he have. You don't have the organization. You don't have the training. So it just doesn't really work. So Nivelle is quite a compelling character. A lot of politicians, certainly British politicians, found him quite an engaging character. They find him quite, he could speak fluent English. So they were naturally drawn to him. But ultimately, he's a great disappointment. And I think that's one of the great, you know, tragedies of the Western Front is it can find you out. War can find you out. If you don't really know what you're doing, if you get out of your depth, as happened to Nivelle, then disaster can happen quite quickly. So, yeah, Nivelle is a really interesting character. Actually, quite little known, really.
Yes, it was a surprise to me, Nick. So we go to the man who replaces Nivelle, Pétain. But you introduced Pétain at Verdun, staring out a window at the troops going up in the morning and dragging themselves in pieces coming back in the afternoon. Is there the poet in French generals, Nick? You've read their archives. Do they compete with each other with poetic language?
Now, that's a really interesting point. I think, you know, some of them do. I think some of them have a way of sort of seeing it in a more lyrical sense than perhaps, you know, other generals. Maybe some of the British generals are somewhat dry. So Douglas Haig's diary is quite dry. But someone like Pétain is quite obviously a deep, you know, an extremely intelligent individual and clearly feels it. And that is, I think, one of the outstanding qualities of Pétain. He's a man who's deeply in touch with what is possible and what is not possible on the battlefield. And I think that's what marks him out for greatness in 1916 and 1917. He understands and he has a deep connection with those troops, what they're going through. And he will never, you know, very, very rarely will he send them into a situation that they won't be able to deal with. So I think that's part of the reason why he becomes a sort of savior of France in a way. And I think he's not particularly young when the war starts. He's a sort of passed over colonel, but he rises very, very quickly to become commander-in-chief of the French army. And he shows a great surety and a great calmness and a great, in, you know, he knows what he needs to do and he does it very well, very, very well. So I think he is one of those great commanders. And, you know, obviously, things change in the Vichy regime in the Second World War, but in the First World War, there's no doubting Pétain's ability and his important role in keeping the French army going through that long war.
The Supreme Allied Commander of April 1918, Marshal Foch, you very much present Foch's plan to end the war. However, I first meet Foch in your explication because he was involved in holding the line, I believe, in France in 1914. Wasn't he part I've written down here the 20th Corps was part of the defense of Paris. So he takes some time to become Supreme Commander. Is he regarded today as the man who effectively in those last 100 days did what nobody else could do using the Canadian forces and the Americans? Is that reputation still standing up, Nick?
I think it is. And I think, Pétain and Foch are quite different individuals, but they're both great commanders in their own way. And I think there's no doubt that Foch is largely regarded as one of the most important, generals that war throws up. He is on the Western Front from 1914 and he's still there in 1918. And he goes through a few ups and downs. He commands a corps in 1914 and becomes, seen as a commander of great skill. And eventually he is, he becomes an army commander. He becomes an army group commander. Eventually falls out with Joffre because he's somewhat, they don't see eye to eye on, how you should fight, because this is up for debate all the time. And then in 1918, when the Allies are faced with perhaps separation and defeat from the German spring offensive, Foch steps in and becomes what they call a generalissimo, a sort of supreme Allied commander. And Foch's great qualities are again, he understands what can and can't be done on the battlefield. And he's never discouraged, whereas Pétain's sort of care and attention on his men, by 1918, this has sort of dragged him down a little bit, where he really doesn't have too much fighting spirit left, because he's so focused on just dragging his army to the end. Foch is... he's like a sort of bouncy ball. He's up and, he's much more energetic character. He's much more charismatic. The British like him. The Americans like him. He's a hero in America. And he becomes a sort of symbol of Allied resistance. So Foch is one of those great commanders. And I think his, recent decades, historians have looked again at Foch and have, I think showed him in a very good light as one of those commanders who is able to coordinate all those different elements, the Americans, the British, the French, all those elements in 1918 in a fully multinational war to victory. So there's no doubting, I think Foch's reputation is probably only going to get stronger as the years go on. He is one of those great characters of the war.
I read him as the Eisenhower of the First War, the man who could pull together all the technology with the personalities and make them work in those last weeks. We're going to turn to the British and the British politics of the war. The book is The Western Front. Nick Lloyd is the author. History of the Great War, 1914 to 1918. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Nick Lloyd. His new book is The Western Front, the first of three volumes of the history of the Great War, 1914 to 1918. The British themselves are a mystery because they put a toe in at the beginning of the conflict. And then what follows is a series of decisions that are both political and military about how to fight and what the aims are. It's striking how it's similar to the putting a toe in 1939 as well. Nick, we need to start with Asquith because he was the prime minister at the time. And Asquith's minister of war was Kitchener. And Kitchener's commander of what will become the British Expeditionary Force that goes to help the French after they're attacked is John French. Those three men don't strike me as comfortable in the room together. Is that correct, Nick?
That is correct. They are they're individuals with very different temperaments and they are thrown together. Asquith is, when the war breaks out, nobody understands or has any idea of how terrible it's going to be. So, you know, Asquith is, at the time of the war breaks out, he's obsessed with a sort of female confidant, Venetia Stanley, that he's, you know, he's very interested in. So he's writing letters to Venetia in the war cabinet. So his focus is somewhere else in many ways. Kitchener is, a professional soldier, you know, one of the great heroes of the empire, Kitchener of Khartoum. And, you know, he is very wary of the British getting involved. I think they've got to do something to keep the French going, but how much they're going to do and the sort of strictly limited deployment of the British is always, always a major political, military, strategic issue, because obviously the British, ideally the British want a small expeditionary force that they can afford, because the British don't have a big army, that will do enough to encourage the French, but without really, you know, exposing the British to massive engagements that we see with the French and the Germans. But of course, for the French, they have to get as many Brits over there as they can, because their appetite can never be sated. And so this is a constant pull. And Kitchener, who has a global view, the British Empire, there's obviously this conflict in the Middle East with Turkey, there's colonial issues, and then naval war, is trying to maintain a sort of limited liability to the Western Front. Whereas for the French, they're consistently pestering the British for more and more manpower, more and more troops. What are the British doing? They need to do this. They need to do that. And ultimately, the man who has to manage that on a day-to-day basis is the commander-in-chief of the British Expeditionary Force, Field Marshal Sir John French. Now, French is, I think, in many ways seen as a rather sad character. You know, he comes out of the Boer War in 1902 as a national hero, one of the great British cavalry commanders. He helps to win that war. But he's out of his depth, as many are, in 1914. And he struggles with the scale and intensity of the war. Now, just remember, the British start, they send to France four divisions and a cavalry division. They have two divisions back home, which they're not sent initially, but they have four divisions. So it's two corps, so it's a small army. At this point, you know, the French have upwards of 80 divisions. The Germans have about over 100. So, you know, you're talking about the British have small fry. And within 18 months, the British have gone to 60 divisions. So the British have gone through a massive expansion. And, you know, French is trying to manage this process. And ultimately, he breaks down at the end of 1915. He's seen so many of his friends killed. He's terrified of the losses. And he is under constant pressure to win decisively on, or at least win small local victories. And he's also under pressure from the French that think he is not doing enough. So French's position is a very difficult one. And ultimately, you know, he's just not able to continue. So at the end of 1915, he's sent home.
I want to look ahead a few years, 1916, when Asquith steps aside, replaced by the minister in charge of munitions, Lloyd George, the little Welshman, as he's described. The little Welshman is a fighter. Kitchener's gone by that time, and French is gone, and there's a whole new general staff. Is Lloyd George credited with winning the war today, 100 years later, Nick? How is he seen militarily, not just politically?
I think certainly in Britain, he's seen as the prime minister that wins the war. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I mean, he still has a reputation as a man of great energy and determination, a man who fought, who has sort of an energy that is really infectious. And so, you know, he inherits a position in sort of the back end of 1916 where the Allies are at a pretty low ebb.
Right.
They fought two terrible battles in 1916 and they haven't really got a lot.
The losses are overwhelming, overwhelming.
Absolutely. So, you know, Asquith is essentially finished by this point. And so Lloyd George comes in and he has to, it's not the same as Winston Churchill in 1940, but there are parallels there, really. And, you know, he is the man that ultimately, you know, he's involved in the setting up of the Ministry of Munitions. And, you know, he tries to really revitalize British industry to re-equip the army. But of course, he has quite poor relations, first of all, with the chief of the Imperial General Staff, Sir William Robertson, and then, of course, with Field Marshal Sir Douglas Haig, Commander-in-Chief of the British Expeditionary Force, who replaces Sir John French, and they do not get on at all. There's a fundamental different strategic outlook, and this sets the scene for some quite significant disagreements in that second half of the war, and that, you know, they just don't see eye to eye. So I think the story, as you go through, is one of almost constant arguments.
And doubts and backstabbing. We'll come to Sir Douglas Haig when we go next to the battlefield that Nick has identified in big pieces, dividing the war into three large themes, 1914 to 1915, 1915 to 1917, 1917 to the end. The book is The Western Front. Nick Lloyd is the author. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, speaking with the author, Nick Lloyd, who is a reader of military and imperial history at King's College in London. His new book is The Western Front, A History of the Great War, Volume 1. There are two more to follow. This one is about the battlefront that we think of as trench warfare, the Great War at the time, called World War I now, 1914 to 1918. It begins with the German attack, and we've discussed these personalities. Now you can see the tension that they lived through in real time. There was a plan called the Schlieffen Plan to take Paris, and it was depending upon the right wing of the German army. The right wing. The left wing, the Germans have armies enough to deploy from Alsace-Lorraine to Verdun into the Marne Valley, the Marne River Valley, all the way to Paris, where they're going to punch through and swing around Paris and end the war. And then, Nick, we go to the crisis at the Marne, as you explicate, and I want to focus very carefully here, Moltke's decision to ask Kluck, commanding the right wing of the army, the First Army. There are seven German armies, and Kluck commands the first, and he seems a very thorough commander, very well chosen. But Moltke decides in the course of the events of August into September that Kluck should not envelop Paris. And the French were preparing to defend Paris to the last man, including letting parts of the city burn or be destroyed with an artillery barrage. They were desperate, despairing, futile at this point if the Germans had entered Paris with the First Army. But Moltke orders him to inward wheel, as you identify it, not to attack southwest, but to attack southeast. The British are south of Kluck, retreating. So I want to start first with the British and then go to the Germans, why they did this, and then go to the French. Sir John French, commanding the British Expeditionary Force, as you've identified, has four divisions and a cavalry division. Allenby, I believe, is in charge of his cavalry. They're falling back for days. And one of the men falling back was the man who will command the British forces in the Second War, Montgomery. So it's wonderful to see Montgomery experiencing the defeat of war. Kitchener gets a note from French that he's going to continue to keep falling back. And I think this is one of the most riveting scenes in your whole story, Nick, and it was very quick. Kitchener jumps on a destroyer, charges across the English Channel, races to the headquarters of the BEF, and what does he tell French? And what does French believe Kitchener's up to?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. This is one of those great scenes where, you know, the British Expedition Force have been surprised at Mons and the Cateau, and, you know, basically they don't really know where the Germans are. They're on the French left, which is obviously on the northern sector, which is slap bang in the path of the Schlieffen Plan, of that swinging door. So the British get overwhelmed quite, or they get nearly overwhelmed a couple of times, and they're in retreat. This is late August 1914. And French is just horrified at this. He just sees these men retreating, and he loses his nerve. He thinks, this is insane. You know, what are we doing here? Where are the French? You know, this is not in the plan. We were just supposed to sort of tidy up the flank and make sure that, you know, to keep the French encouraged. And all of a sudden now, he's facing the entire might of the German army. Remember, the First Army, von Kluck's First German Army, is over 300,000 men strong. It's absolutely enormous. The British are about 100,000. And so there's a possibility that the entire British Expeditionary Force can be destroyed in detail in August 1914. It's absolutely horrifying. And so French wires Kitchener and says, look, I'm going to essentially retreat and go for a break. We're going to sort of essentially get out of the line and refit. We need to refit. And, of course, Kitchener is horrified at this, because if the British do this, essentially abandoning the French, then this is, you know, politically and strategically very, very bad. Potentially could cause the alliance to shatter, like you see in 1940. So Kitchener comes and basically, we don't exactly know what happens at the meeting. No minutes were recorded, but we can piece it together. And, Kitchener essentially orders French to stay in the line and do what he can. And of course, French finds this quite humiliating. He thinks Kitchener just doesn't understand what he's going through. And it sets the scene for poor relations between the two of those, for the next year. And again, it's an indication, which is one of the themes of the book, of the stresses and strains of war. This war is far bigger, far more dangerous, far more bloody than anyone had expected. And for a small army like the British, you cannot lose that many casualties, because if you do, the British simply do not have another army to replace it with. The French have a big army. They have lots of people who are trained. And so if you lose one army, you have five of them, then that's obviously terrible, but you can continue. If the British lose the expeditionary force, they cannot be replaced, or they can't be replaced quickly. So again, this is the kind of pressure that people like French are under.
Why did Moltke order Kluck to move from attacking southwest to envelop Paris to attacking southeast? Why did he do that?
Well, this is one of the great controversies, certainly in the German literature, of the 1914 campaign. Generations of historians and soldiers have looked at first, how the Schlieffen plan fails, and they try to work out where it went wrong and how and whether it could have succeeded. And ultimately, what happens is Kluck is supposed to lead that whole swinging door around Paris. Very quickly, they make an idea that they understand that they can't do it. They just don't have the manpower. They're getting stretched. And so they decide to essentially pass through pass east of Paris. And Moltke is okay with this. What Moltke eventually does several days later, he orders von Kluck to stop. So this goes against the central tenet of the Schlieffen plan, which von Kluck has, he understands very well, that the First Army, his sort of extended flank, will continue until it slams the door shut on the French army. But of course, as the campaign goes on, Moltke is worried about the flank becoming more and more open. And so essentially he orders von Kluck to stop, and then von Kluck essentially ignores him. So essentially what happens is you have a complete collapse of command and control in the German army. German armies are just too big for an individual like Moltke to command. He's in Luxembourg. He is miles away. And they just can't get everyone they need to go in the right places. And I think that's one of the big problems with 1914, because although they use railways to get them to their deployment areas, once they step off that railway station, German soldiers walk. They will walk. By the time they get to the Marne, von Kluck's men have gone, hundreds of miles, and they're absolutely exhausted. So, again, we can talk about the Marne and why the Germans don't win. I think it's a combination of factors. But, of course, the blame game. Was it Kluck? Was Kluck right? Was von Moltke, wrong? This goes on after the war. And I think just, to tie it up, my view, I think it's difficult for the Germans to win in 1914. Perhaps they could have done some things differently. But I do think it was a mistake perhaps not to go into Paris, because Paris has a sort of symbolic significance that's obviously very important.
Right.
So the other factor is, of course, most of French industry, Peugeot, Creusot, all those big industrial factories are in and around Paris. So if the Germans hold them, or at least destroy them, France can't continue the war.
You have a scene with Joffre. He's at Chateau Marmont. He has a conversation. He's given the order to die on the spot. He has a conversation, and he looks outside the window. It's a scene that it's art. That's what it is, Nick. I mean, it's as if Joffre knew we'd be talking about him 100 years later. The quote you give is, "Now heaven will decide." That was his personality. He did everything he could, and then he said, "Heaven decides." Was he lucky?
Yeah.
Was he lucky?
Yeah.
Is that it?
No, I don't think he was. I think that the scene that you're mentioning is, it's recorded by one of the liaison officers who meets Joffre, one of the French liaison officers. And I found it, you know, quite moving actually, because essentially what happens is Joffre doesn't think the Germans are going to move that much men through Belgium. He doesn't think they have the numbers. But when, so his forces are not able to react to that. So what happens is, as it becomes apparent that the Germans are massing huge numbers of troops to the north, he has to react and he has to move rapidly north. He has to move a lot of forces from his right to his left. And he does that. He shuttles and then he shuttles the manpower through Paris. And then on the evening of the 5th of September, he orders the armies, which have been in full retreat for over a week now, he orders them to stand and, if necessary, die on the spot and then counterattack. Or, and this is the, this will become the Battle of the Marne, which destroys the Schlieffen plan. And I think it alludes to the point I made earlier about Joffre. He has that gravity, he has the nerve, and he has the sort of groundedness, I think, to say, you know what? I've done what I can. We're in position. We can outflank von Kluck. We can get round his back. All the armies can then march forward together to counterattack. And they counterattack on the Marne, which is one of the great battles of the 20th century. And that's, you know, Joffre is the man that manages that. And it would have been very easy for him to lose in 1914 if he'd lost his head, if he'd have confused his deployments, but he doesn't. He trusts in God. He gets it right on the battlefield. He counterattacks. He fights the Germans to a standstill. And then the 9th of September, after 3 days of heavy, heavy fighting, terrible casualties, the Germans retreat. Yeah. So they retreat back from the Marne. And they set up positions on the Aisne River. And that's the start of trench warfare.
That is the beginning.
So the Germans fail in 1914. Yeah, and that is because of Joffre's plan and the Battle of the Marne. So the stakes don't get any higher than that.
We're going to go to September 1915, the Second Battle of Champagne, because it will become clear in this battle that there is no winning. The book is The Western Front. Nick Lloyd is the author. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Nick Lloyd, the author of the new book, The Western Front, the story of the Great War, 1914 to 1918, and trench warfare. We go now to September 1915, the Second Battle of Champagne. The French go on the offensive. And what I learned from you, Nick, in your explanation of these events, the casualty rates are very high here, September 25th to October 6th, 1915, is that both sides, Falkenhayn commanding the Germans and Joffre commanding the French, both sides have an ability to understand that you cannot break through, that every time you think you're making a breakthrough to range behind the enemy and turn his corner, there'll be a second and third and a fallback defense, because it's not siege. It is not siege combat. What does that mean to them when they say this isn't siege mentality?
I think it's a realization that they can't break through in the way that they imagine that they would. And I think all of the commanders on all of the sides are trying to work out, you know, how you can fight, how you can win. And most of them see trench warfare as essentially a kind of anomaly, as a strange situation that will only be temporary. And what you need to do is you need to mass combat power in certain key sectors and essentially drive it home as hard as you can to break that front line, that front series of trenches, and then push reinforcements in and through. And then that will essentially shatter trench warfare, and then movement will reoccur. And then once movement reoccurs, you can have a decisive battle. So you know, the early part of the war, they try and do this, and ultimately throughout 1915, the Allies try to do this, they can gain certain, they can have local breakthroughs, they can gain little bits of ground here and there, but they're not able to do that grand shattering breakthrough. And the September-October 1915 battle is where they put everything in. They put everything they've learned, they mass forces in Champagne. And again, they can gain a mile or two, but they just can't break the trench deadlock in the way that they had hoped. And after that, I think there's a growing recognition that breaking through cannot be achieved, at least in the foreseeable future. So I think this is what makes the Western Front so interesting, is that you see commanders trying to work out what they can't do, what they can do. And often their responses are quite logical. But of course, giving up the idea of a breakthrough is quite a difficult one for many commanders to grapple with, as well as politicians, because the overriding, you know, mission is to liberate French territory, is to get the Germans off French land. And they simply can't do that in the way that they'd imagined. And that's one of the key stories of the book, is the different responses and the different developments that they undergo in order to try and find a way to win. And it's not obvious and it's not simple. And I think some of the criticisms of the Western Front commanders are there was another alternative way. And, you know, in many cases, it was always going to be extremely difficult, bloody, and whatever progress the Allies might make, the Germans will respond. And there's this constant evolution. So whereas the French have managed to break the first line, the Germans then build a second and a third line, and they thicken that up and they put more artillery, more machine guns, more barbed wire. You know, the Allies use more artillery, and then the Germans then essentially, instead of having one line, they have a whole zone of, you know, of pillboxes and this kind of thing. So there's a constant evolution, and you see that through the book. And I think that is one thing that I think it's really important that people understand about this war.
After Champagne, that's when French goes and Haig takes over. After Champagne, that's when Falkenhayn recognizes that he has someone who is brilliant in defense named Losberg. I noted Losberg because he will come back later. He gives the die-in-place order to the Third Army. The other general I noticed was from the French side, Castelnau. I liked Castelnau. Why is that? Why did you make me like him, Nick? What about him?
I think he's quite a warm individual. He's quite a, you know, he's got some charisma about him. He becomes Joffre's chief of staff. He's a man that's, you know, deeply religious. He has a friar that sort of ministers to him on the battlefield. And he's a man that loses three sons in the war. So I think Castelnau is an example of a senior commander who really personally feels the desolation and horror of war. And I think too often, certainly in the British popular perception, the cliches of the war, these generals, they're black and white photos. They're old men. They're bearded men. They just seem cardboard cutouts. And I really wanted to try and bring them to life and see these were humans. These were individuals with families, with backgrounds. In many cases were deeply, you know, horrified at what they were having to do, but had to do it nonetheless. And I think and again, many of them made a lot of mistakes. So I think appreciating that in a warmer, more direct sense was really important to me. And Castelnau is one of those characters where you kind of root for him because he seems like he is a good individual. He's a man that, you know, does his best. And we can talk about the other generals as well. So there are characters I liked and I warmed to as I wrote the book. There's others that I was never that sure of. And, you know, again, I leave it up to the readers to have their own favorites. And, you know, I have my own favorites and, sure, you know, I warmed to some as we went through. And I think that was a really important part of the book for me.
We're going to the battles. Verdun and Somme are twinned in Nick's presentation. The Western Front is the book. Nick Lloyd is the author. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Nick Lloyd, the author, Nick Lloyd, of the new book, The Western Front. Nick is a reader in military and imperial history at King's College. And no matter where you read military history, Verdun and Somme will come up. Verdun is the Germans on the offensive. Somme is the British and the French on offensive. What I learned from Nick's presentation is they're twinned. First Verdun. It launches in early 1916. It's a fortress, a series of fortresses, way out to the right, very far from Paris. Why, Nick? Why did they launch? Why did Falkenhayn launch on Verdun? What did he imagine he would accomplish? And in accomplishing it, how would it end the war? His vision.
Yeah, I mean, you get 1916. There's that terrible, terrible year where you get these two battles, as you mentioned. And this year is almost the image of the Western Front that we have. When we think of the Western Front, it's usually 1916 or 1917. Verdun and the Somme are those two horrific battles that, you know, have come to epitomize that horror. Verdun is interesting because Falkenhayn has spent 1915 essentially winning the war in the East and conquering Serbia, destroying parts of the Russian army. And then he returns to the West in 1916 and decides to attack the French. And the whole idea, and he's not that explicit about it at the time. Sometimes he throws a bit of sand in people's eyes. But the whole idea is we can't really break through. That's not really what I need to do. What I need to do is kill Frenchmen. And I need to ratchet the slaughter up so high that they will give up. So it's a very modern, it's a very ruthless perception. It's quite different. You know, it's quite different to other battles where certainly in the early stages of the war, Allied commanders want to break through. They want to gain ground. Killing Germans is kind of secondary. For Falkenhayn, that's the primary goal. And that's why Verdun becomes this sort of concentrated experiment in killing.
It's a meat locker. My goodness. The battles are impossible to separate. It's one constant massacre on both sides. And the French keep feeding forces in. The Germans keep feeding forces in. And shells. They're always running low on shells. The one person who seemed to have an ability to innovate, wasn't it Petain who rotated divisions into the front line, and the Germans just used them until they were exhausted?
Yes, that's correct. You get Petain comes in and manages the defensive battle in Verdun, and he does this rotation, so divisions will not be in line for that long. Now, again, they might take heavy losses, but he'll bring them out. He'll make sure they get care, they get appropriate, what we might call R&R. German divisions would stay in the line until basically there's not a lot left, and then the remnants would be brought out. But on both sides, you get this terrible exchange of losses, and Verdun's actually quite a small battlefield, so the concentration of firepower and artillery in that small area is really, really frightening. And it produces this great moonscape effect. And that's what certainly horrified Petain when he saw it, and he saw what it did to men. And he saw the shattered remnants of it come back, and I think that really struck him quite deeply. So, you know, Verdun is one of those critical battles which ultimately is not decisive. The French aren't destroyed. The casualty rates are actually quite similar. So Falkenhayn is never able to ratchet it up so much that he's not losing a lot of manpower. And it's almost like, as I went through the book, I think, until the end of 1915, the Germans are in a pretty good position. They're good in the East. They've really damaged the Russian army. They've conquered Serbia. And they've held on in the West. And they're almost in a position where you could think they are well ahead in the war. But the decision to mount the attack on Verdun in February 1916 is the moment where things start to go wrong for Germany. And I would argue she never really recovers.
It is very clear from your presentation to me, the reader, that some was meant to relieve the pressure on Verdun. However, all of a sudden you had other interests, other ambitions, including those who said that this would be the opportunity, with the Germans distracted or drained by Verdun, to break through. It's Haig again. Always the offensive spirit. And I want to jump into a dispute that I can imagine is carried on for 100 years. Rawlinson was Haig's choice to lead the Battle of the Somme, which is launching in the summer of 16. Rawlinson believes in bite and hold. What did that mean? And what did that mean to Haig?
I think this is a really important part of the book, because you have this relief offensive and the idea that the British are finally in 1916 And we've mentioned how small the British were in 1914 when the war starts. By 1916, they're much bigger, but they're quite green and they aren't really tested in that sense. They've undergone an enormous expansion and they want to attack on the Somme. And quite quickly, you have this difference of opinion between Haig, commander-in-chief, and Rawlinson, his army commander, about how you should attack on the Western Front. And I think it's indicative of the currents of thought that are going on, the sort of bubbled away through 1915 about how you fight on the Western Front. Now, Haig always has a reputation, certainly in Britain, as this sort of stale, attritional commander. But Haig is always quite, you know, optimistic in what he wants to achieve. And what he wants to do on the Somme is break through and maneuver and get his men and his cavalry out in the open where they can defeat the German army. So quite traditional in that sense. Rawlinson says, and he's more like the kind of tradition that you get in the French army, which is actually the point is not to do that. So Rawlinson says, well, gaining a few miles of French farmland isn't that important. What is important is killing Germans. So you can see the echo of Falkenhayn and Verdun. And he says, what we can do is we could concentrate our artillery on the first and second lines and smash them, take them, stop, bring the guns up. We made the bite. We'll hold on and then we'll do it again. We won't break through. We'll just gradually we'll gradually break down the German defenses. And again, this goes on and Haig does not like this. And Haig never really moves from this idea of breakthrough. So he doesn't really like what Rawlinson is offering. But I would argue that the British are only really capable of what Rawlinson is suggesting in 1916. They can take the first line of trenches a little bit more maybe, but that's all they can really do because they don't have the artillery. They don't have the know-how. They don't have the weapon systems to go further. So the debate between Haig and Rawlinson is really interesting, and it illustrates the different approaches that different commanders had to the kind of dilemmas that the Western Front presents.
The British cabinet was reluctant about some or mixed about some. The idea was we were working with the French. So I want to go to the French quickly here because we've mentioned Nivelle before, who was only briefly commander-in-chief. He replaces Joffre. However, the question here is, were the French demanding the British work with them, or were these separate armies with separate audiences looking for advantage back home? The puzzle is Nivelle's offensive. You know it very well, April 17. The Somme and Verdun have lasted long enough so that they're no longer the focus. The hills are covered with bones. But Nivelle's idea is to launch an offensive to break through, a tactical advantage. He believes that he can succeed with a massive number of guns, with air power. In other words, they're beginning to fight a three-dimensional war. He wants the British to help him by launching an attack on Vimy Ridge. However, there's a war council, April of 17, with Nivelle, Castelnau, Pétain, Despréi, Michelet of the 6th, Mangin, who will lead the 6th Army, and Nivelle. What is the debate that right before the Nivelle offensive, what is the hesitation or the concern for the French political life?
What we see is that these two great battles, the Somme and Verdun, that we talked about, smolder on through 1916, but ultimately they are a terrible experience for the Germans, for the British, for the French. But decisive victory seems quite far away. And, you know, there's this growing sense of impatience, as you can imagine. And Nivelle is promoted. Joffre, as I mentioned before, is kicked upstairs. They need someone fresh, someone with new ideas. And Nivelle seems to have what he calls the formula. And so they don't really know what the original plan for 1917 is to continue the Somme into 1917. That's what Haig wants to do. But when Joffre is kicked upstairs, all the plans get essentially scrubbed and it starts again. Now, Nivelle's perspective is the French cannot continue the war for much longer. They are running out of manpower. They're running out of patience. There's only so much they're going to do. And so he believes that with the right artillery support, with the right gunfire, with the right plan, he can essentially do what Joffre had wanted to do in 1915, which is break through on that crucial sector along the Chemin des Dames, not Champagne, which is what Joffre wanted. Nivelle chooses the Chemin des Dames. And they can do this, and they must do this now, or else they will fail. And so this sets the scene for what will become, you know, one of the darkest periods of the war for the Allies. And the British aren't particularly, they are not really that happy with this, but Lloyd George, who distrusts Haig, quite likes Nivelle. And from his perspective is, well, if the French are going to do the fighting, the French are going to lead this attack, well, we can support them. And so he orders Haig to support them. So this causes quite a bit of ill feeling between the British and French. But ultimately it goes ahead. And I think this illustrates one of the problems of the Allies' war, certainly in the first half of the war, is the British and French largely fight separate wars. Now, they are joined side by side on the Western Front, but there isn't a unified commander, there isn't unified staff, there's not unified training or weapons procurement or supplies. The French do their thing, the British do our thing. And if we can coordinate time, you know, we'll attack at the same time or whatever we can do. But it's quite limited, and I think that's one of the big problems that the Allies have, which is only really solved with the, you know, the ascension of Ferdinand Foch, who we talked about a bit earlier, in 1918. It's one of the key lessons that the Allies learn during the war. They have to work together much more closely than either, you know, the British or French really would like. Certainly the British are the problem here, because they don't particularly want to be subordinated to the French. For the French, they would love to subordinate the British, but that is difficult for the British for many, many reasons.
What it looks like is that Haig launches his attack in April. He's said, yes, I'll support you. He launches his attack, and they take the Vimy Ridge. They do a wonderful job. And you have a grisly observation as they take Vimy Ridge, that the bones of the Moroccans who were there in 15 are still on the ground. It's an incredible scene of gore. But they take it. And Haig is successful. And yet, Nivelle's offensive is quite independent of whether that would have been successful or not. In addition, Nivelle's defensive is, as you emphasized, tactical. Nivelle seems quite out of his depth. Is that an opinion today, Nick?
I think so. I mean, I think we would love a new biography of Nivelle. I think, you know, there's limited work on him, but a new biography would be really interesting to read. He's a very interesting character. But I think you're right. I think ultimately he's just not able to make that leap from essentially a battlefield commander to a national commander in chief that can see the strategy, can see the big picture, as it were. And he miscalculates badly in 1917 in terms of what the French can do. Tries to do the big breakthrough again, which is really, really difficult to do in that 16-17 period, because the defenses are too thick and you don't have the kind of technology, the mobility, the vehicles that will allow you to break through. So he tries to do too much, and ultimately the morale issue, you know, the French have lost you, you know.
Well, mutiny, revolution. So, yes, execution.
So the Allies come close. Yeah, absolutely. The Allies come very close to losing the war in 1917. Yeah. I think that's why the American involvement is so crucial.
Yes, let's go to the Americans. Pershing's about to arrive, and that changes the atmosphere both in Germany and in France. Nick Lloyd is the author. The Western Front is the new story of the first volume of the history of the Great War, 1914-1918, a war that will determine the 20th century and maybe the 21st. Too early to tell. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Nick Lloyd is here. His new book is The Western Front, History of the Great War, 1914-1918. It is June of 1917. A cavalryman in high, shiny boots with a stiff collar, drab olive, arrives in Paris to celebration, cheering from the rooftops. His name is Pershing. A couple of months before, he was riding horses in Mexico and was in Texas in the heat of the Texas summer. And because he spoke French and because his commander died of a heart attack right before, Wilson called him up. President Wilson beckoned him to say, I'm sending you the head of the American Expeditionary Force, because in April of 1917, Wilson and the Congress declared war on Germany and Austria. And Pershing arrives without an army. There were only 113,000 men in the army when Pershing was riding around in Mexico seeking Pancho Villa. He's without an army, but he's going to bring an army with him. And what they want is amalgamation. Let's term on this, because amalgamation will not work. Pershing's idea is we're going to fight alone. Nick, 100 years later, is Pershing right or is Foch right? Should they have all been put together?
No, I think Pershing is right. I think, you know, the amalgamation, when America enters the war in April 1917, the French said, look, you know, you don't really know how to fight. You don't have the equipment. Why don't you just give us your manpower? Because that's your strongest asset. And we will train them. They'll work in our divisions. And this will be a way that we can essentially re-energize and we can win. And understandably, the Americans say, well, no, you're not, you know, you perhaps don't have the best record of not killing your own troops. So actually, no. We might consent to some training missions and coordination on this or that, but you're not going to have American soldiers, you know, under French officers and that kind of thing. So the amalgamation issue goes through the book, and you see it in multiple chapters where it reappears. It reappears where the Allies say, well, just give us your manpower. And the Americans say, well, we are not allied to you. We're an associate power, remember? So we're not, you know, we don't have a formal alliance. We are fighting the war, but we're in a semi-independent sense. So working out what role the Americans can play is a constant issue. And the Allies get quite desperate at times because they say to the Americans, look, you're going to have to make serious contribution or we are going to go under. And at one point, Lloyd George says to Pershing, he says, well, this is in the following year, 1918, there's a great crisis at the front. He says, well, if the British and French go under, we at least can say we have done everything. We've given our all. Whereas if, you know, well, what can the Americans say? They've provided fewer troops than Belgium. Of course, this great wounding comparison, you know, Pershing doesn't flinch when he's faced with this insult by the British Prime Minister, but it illustrates how desperate the Allies become by the following year. I think the key question with the Americans is how quickly they can get manpower in and how serious they are at it. And the Germans don't think the Americans are serious. They think it will be years before they can build an army. And so they underestimate the Americans terribly. And ultimately, that is one of the things which causes the end of the war. Because once the Americans demonstrate that they are serious, which they do by 1918, then clearly the writing is very much on the wall.
Yes, it's Foch's plan. It's magnificent. Attack in the north, attack in the center, attack in the south. He tests the Americans in a smaller battle, not in the hot sector, and then he puts them into Chateau Thierry, right in the center. They drive up. The closing weeks of the war are extremely dramatic and incredibly detailed. What we have time for here is to concentrate on something that will curse the 20th century. It's the idea that the Germans were not defeated on the battlefield, that they were permitted to withdraw in good order to the German border, that the army did not surrender, that instead they were betrayed in Berlin and in Paris and in London. And this is what will be preached to the German population in 1920s and 1930s and will be one of the drivers for the organization we now remember badly as the Third Reich. Nick, was the decision to allow the Germans to withdraw and not just surrender their arms, is that considered to be a poor decision 100 years later?
I think it's still controversial. And the stab in the back legend, which you allude to, it's one of the most, you know, pernicious myths of the war. And I think I show in the book that German army is falling apart. It's being defeated rapidly in 1918, the last stages of it. But ultimately the Allies have to make a decision about whether they want to and are willing to continue the war and to go into Germany. And obviously the Americans are more keen to do this than the other Allies because clearly they're much fresher. They're not.
We just have 30 seconds, Nick. I'm sorry. Go ahead. 30 seconds.
But I think, you know, my argument is the Germans are defeated in 1918, but I understand why they didn't, the Allies did not go into Germany, because I think politically that would be much more difficult for the British and French that are, after all, totally exhausted. So, you know, the armistice is fair, I think, on all sides, but it doesn't mean, I think, that the Germans were not defeated. They were defeated in 1918 and they sued for peace.
The book is The Western Front. Nick Lloyd is the author, the first of three volumes, A History of the Great War, 1914 to 1918. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.